Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work. People who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Hello and welcome. My name is Leslie Bernard. I'm excited to be talking to a person who I've known for many years about an issue that's near and dear to my heart. Today's guest is Dr. Jackie Copeland, a foundation and corporate grantmaker, scholar activist, environmentalist, and technologist who's devoted her life to making the world a better place. Jackie is also the founder of Black Philanthropy Month. As we find ourselves in the midst of Black Philanthropy Month, we wanted to share this conversation with you now so you can learn more about Jackie's work. Jackie and I spoke via Zoom, and I'm excited to share this conversation with you. Please enjoy.
Jackie, it's so good to be with you today.
Thank you.
Good to see you. It's been a minute. We've known each other for a while, since college, actually. But you've gone on since then to do so many amazing things. A couple of master's degrees, a doctorate in cultural anthropology, a career in philanthropy, doing foundation grant making, corporate grant making, establishing some social enterprises, and really being a champion of women and folks in the African diaspora. So much in a lifetime. But, you know, I want you to take me back. Really help me understand that little girl from Philly who didn't know all these things were possible. What were the influences that shaped her view of the world and her place in it and what she really believed was possible?
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here, particularly doing the interview with you. Never forgot you, and were always brilliant and kind. And so thank you for this opportunity. The little girl from Philly is still here. And so going way, way back at this point, I would say a primary influence was my mother's guidance. I now openly share that racial and skin color hazing, limited financial means were all a part of my childhood, especially starting from about age 10. And I would say my mother's folk philosophies and faith in particular helped ground me, and they're a part of my worldview now. So the first thing she told me was, in dealing with people who don't like you just because of who you are, or whether it's because you're female or just how you look or whatever the case, she said, always remember that you are a child of God. Everyone else is too, but they just don't know it. Mm-hmm. So as a kid who really worshiped her mother and like took every word she said literally, it was very empowering. And I got this sense that if I were a child of God, I could actually do just about anything, no matter what anybody else said. The other piece of that is she told me, and remember, God trumps everything. And so for me, people always ask, you know, well, why do you feel so comfortable? You're from this inner city hood in Philly. It's like, who do you think you are? And the story of my brain is, I'm a child of God, just like you. I'm supposed to do it. It's my human right and responsibility. So that was major in terms of faith and resilience. I'll always remember, as a very studious child of modest means, young person, worrying about how I was going to get in college or pay for college, I had my eldest cousin very accomplished woman, and I shared my concerns with her. And she said, well, you know, if you get good grades, strangers will give you money to go to Georgetown. And at the time, I was like, yeah, I mean, who are these people? What do you mean? She said, they're called scholarships. And I was just amazed. And in addition to that, my cousin's introduction to that form of philanthropy, I grew up watching my aunts and my mom tithe and do all kinds of volunteerism in the community, give to legacy organizations like the NAACP, all kinds of institutions for the broader community as well. And so I cultivated this sense that to be a responsible adult, you need to be like humbly confident. You need to have a sense of purpose, some faith, resilience. And I was just curious. I still wake up every day excited about what I'm going to learn, consider it a big adventure. I was a writer as a kid, a songwriter as a kid. So, and an organizer of people, because one of the things that happened is my idyllic neighborhood started to have some serious problems. I didn't have any name for what was happening, but I knew men were losing their jobs. Families were breaking up, and issues started happening in the neighborhood that didn't happen before, such as the drug trade. So I got very curious about, number one, what are these invisible forces that can come through your neighborhood like a storm? You don't even see and turn people's lives topsy-turvy. And Philly is a city of neighborhoods, people often say, but it's also a city of blocks. So our block was having a very hard time, but an adjacent block was blossoming. And I realized that that was a big question in my mind. What can you do to in a neighborhood, in a community, to keep it safe? We went from, you know, hide and seek at night and catching fireflies in mason jars to being stuck in the house due to concerns of violence. And so that stuck with me. It's like, how can I give people the idyllic childhood and environment that I used to have, and what's going on here?
Let's talk a little bit sort of about that. So this sort of, this girl that's full of courage and competence and a sense of purpose from the faith she has and all that she's seeing in the world. Help me understand, like, as you entered into your journey in philanthropy, what you saw going on in your neighborhood, how you translated that sort of at a local, community, national, maybe even global level to address some of those challenges you saw. How did you see philanthropy as a tool? You mentioned it, that you realized at a young age through family members, oh, that could be used to support your educational aspirations and goals. But how did you see it sort of as a tool to address the things that you saw in that Philly neighborhood growing up or in the world writ large?
Well, I was sharing more of my early childhood. This really has been a long journey with a lot mm-hmm. of phases. And like most people who work in the field of philanthropy, I didn't see that as a career. I just knew, and in fact, we didn't use the term, like most Black communities don't necessarily use the term philanthropy. We just knew we were supposed to give and be a part of the solution. And if you help other people, you can also help yourself. That was just the colloquial mm-hmm. way of understanding it as a responsibility and actually a tool of healing. whatever challenges were going on in one's life, giving was like part of a toolkit to help you heal. Mm-hmm. And so I think going to college and particularly being in the African Studies program at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, where as you may remember, you had to go to Africa to study and do original research to get your credential. And so I think a turning point where I was able to translate my like proto vision of myself, my strong motivation to be the change, came from that experience. And at that time, I had already declared anthropology as my major, because I realized that a lot of the histories and ethnographies about Black communities just did not represent the community I knew. It was mostly focused, they were mostly focused on the glass half empty. And so I very much wanted to study history, understand how culture was produced and replicated, especially in diasporas, when you or your ancestors are forced out of some ancestral homeland and have to refashion one's identity and culture, often in less than ideal circumstances. And so that experience of the experience of Nigeria and going deep and understanding some of the cultural, historical, socioeconomic elements of poverty and advantage is what led me specifically to a career in community development. And at that point, my vision, my career vision, is that I wanted to be able to do what I called at the time cross-cultural community development. Be able to have a really clear technical toolkit to develop communities, economically empower them, work on housing access and quality for low-income people, and be able to do that in such a way that I made a real difference. Also had an interest in environmental issues because the neighborhood I grew up in was also very polluted. So in Nigeria, I declared that interest in doing community development everywhere. I was sure at the time that was my career mission. And then, I had from an early age had to figure out how to get money to fund my dreams. I would always say, well, dreams are expensive, so I need to figure out how to raise money. I didn't have a term for fundraising, but that started when I was trying to get all those scholarships to go to Georgetown. And so as I contemplated, how is community development funded? I started this practice of fundraising from foundations, went to graduate school and worked with a think tank at the Wharton School, where most of our clients were foundations. And I was hired to design evaluations of issues like helping foundations know when a community participation program they were funding was actually working. What does that look like in different countries and different communities, and how do you quantify it?
Sounds like your life experience brought you to that point where you realized there was a need for this in terms of elevating sort of giving to within the African diaspora and African communities globally, as well as locally. So talk to us about how how that started, Black Philanthropy Month.
Yeah, different threads. So I mentioned being at the Philadelphia Foundation, and we were really committed to working with everyone. We took community seriously. I will say that some community foundations, the primary constituency is wealthy people in the community, just because of how community foundations had typically started as extensions of bank trust departments. And so at Philly, we would look for ways to empower the entire community. And so we started actually helping Black churches create endowments. And this was part of a broader plan. We worked with the emergent queer community, immigrants. I was really proud of that work because we included everyone. And so I think my first study of for the practical purposes of helping Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia create its first endowment really got me more deeply involved in the particular challenges facing Black nonprofit and other voluntary sector organizations, how fundraising worked in the community, how it could be better, not just financial inclusion, how to increase the impact of the giving that happened, how the church actually kind of operated like a classic African giving circle or investment club in the community, and how powerful and pervasive this giving was through churches, sororities, fraternities. And then this happened to coincide with a time where there were scholars actually studying African-American philanthropy, and there were the first studies to actually quantify it. And then there was a finding that this maybe 30 years ago, that African-American communities gave the highest percentage of their income in philanthropy compared to all other U.S. ethnic groups. And so that was fascinating. I knew as a person from the culture and a professional working with Black philanthropic organizations like the church, that this, it was more than an activity. It was also almost like a defining aspect of African-American culture. And then I knew that there was an increasingly ethnically diverse Black community with Africans, Black Caribbean people, Afro-Latinos coming from all over the world. And so I got interested in documenting that. No one was talking about it. The focus was mostly only on African-American philanthropy, but I think because I had that early research and work experience in Nigeria, I became interested also in the diaspora and global elements. And sort of fast forwarding, I finished my dissertation, and that was actually a study of what is called in some circles a Pan-African or Black diasporan philanthropy and community organization, working on creating more inclusive identities for people of African descent in what they call Pan-African identity, and there were all kinds of identities. I was living in Minneapolis at that time, and it was really interesting because people I had worked with in different parts of Africa for showing up as parents at my daughter's school. These are people that I was working with in the mid 80s. And suddenly it was like all of Africa was coming to Minneapolis. And it was the strangest thing. And then the 2000 census confirmed what I was experiencing, is that Minneapolis, St. Paul had the most diverse Black community in terms of ethnicity of any other metropolitan area in the US. Specifically, more Somali, more Kenyan, and more Liberian. And then women started in particular calling on me, and I became somehow like the pro bono consultant for every Black community that wanted to create a nonprofit or raise money. And remember, I always had this commitment to giving back no matter what my day job was. And so it occurred to me that although I had a very diverse network, I was also helping the Hmong community, and always just trying to build those bridges so people would feel like they were part of one community and that they could access the resources they needed. Time, talent, treasure, voice, connections. To make their community better. And so my simple idea initially was to share my network with my African-American friends, women friends and pro bono clients, because I knew the African-Americans did not know all of the Black immigrants from other parts of the world and vice versa. And in fact, people work in silos and there are a lot of misconceptions, fragmentation. And at the time, I was a vice president and managing director I created the private philanthropy advisory service at US Bank, but I also was a senior fellow at University of Minnesota. And so the university became like a host site for a series of lunches, get-togethers with this very diverse network of women, started at about 20 women. I called it the Pan-African Women's Philanthropy Network. It's now called ReUnity. And the rich fundraising and philanthropic structures, particularly my exposure to what we would call their giving circles, which are also investment clubs. And I noticed the Somalis built a shopping mall and they couldn't even get banked. They couldn't. It was fascinating to me. And as I learned that they were pooling their resources in these rotating credit and giving pools that were providing a source of financing. So that group became a mutual support group. It grew, and its ingenuity around philanthropy and what we would call today impact investing is what inspired me to create Black Philanthropy Month. Also, there's this continuing, tired, completely backwards and racist notion that Black people don't give, that somehow we're the only group of people on the planet who don't give, even though there had been at that time 15 to 20 years of research proving quantifiably that we not only give, but we give a higher proportion of our income in philanthropy. Even today, in some circles in philanthropy and fundraising, there's still this belief that we don't give. And so my aim, especially after this experience with this group I founded, the Pan-African Women's Philanthropy Network, is first, I wanted the Black community to understand how powerful his giving was, to fully embrace it, that it was that no foundation had funded our movements, starting, especially in the beginning with, let's say, the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, that all that money in the early phases all came from our community. And so
we have a history there then in terms of supporting one another in our social, racial aspirations. The history.
Well, aspirations not just for ourselves, but also supporting the broader community. And I wanted people to understand that if we were more collective and strategic in our giving, we together could make an impact on issues, and we could promote economic justice, which I see is like the last frontier of the civil rights movement. We take two steps forward and one step backwards on private capital access. There's still redlining. There's still many barriers that disadvantage our community economically. So first, that self-awareness and empowerment of our collective giving. I also wanted the broader field in the world to know about this cultural treasure of Black giving and how it has impacted not just the US, but the world. And I wanted to build inclusive networks to empower Black philanthropy and funding equity that actually pulled together African Americans with other Black people of various national and ethnic origins. And so at the Philly Foundation, way back when, I had worked with this whole concept of action summits, where you convene a diverse group of people, sometimes over several days. I had started using polling technology to identify common cause and solutions to shared challenges. And so I took that model and created this whole notion of Pan-African summits around philanthropy, empowering philanthropy and advancing funding equity. And we did our first summit in 2006, which was kind of a test run. And then I launched Black Philanthropy Month at a Pan-African Women's Philanthropy Network summit that brought several hundred Black women from all over the world and some of our allies of all backgrounds, as far as Australia, Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria, various Caribbean countries to Minneapolis in 2011. And it was transformative. And we're celebrating the 10th year of that first Black Philanthropy Month. I was also inspired to create Black Philanthropy Month because the UN had declared 2011 as the international year for people of African descent, recognizing that there were cultural commonalities as well as shared challenges and opportunities because of histories of, because we come from the same cultural root in Africa, but also because of histories of slavery and continuing racism and neocolonialism in some instances. And so I wanted to use, that later became the decade for people of African descent, which we're still in. The UN had also, or the African Union had declared it as the decade for women of African descent, looking at shared experiences of sexism, poverty, and racism And so that inspired me as well. And even the whole model of the League of Women Voters, right? Women do a lot of the heavy lifting for philanthropy and civic engagement. And there's that certainly that history in the Black community, the broader community. And so that organization, well, PopNet is now called Reunity, as I mentioned. And there's kind of a family of initiatives within the Women Invested to Save Earth Fund. Black Philanthropy Month is one of the initiatives that we support. And then we're keeping PopNet, Reunity, going strong with an annual women's rally. And we developed something called the Global Black Women's Manifesto. The whole concept for that original summit as well was, how can women, Black women in particular, be well while doing good? We see in the current controversies around Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka, basically saying, you know, the Black superwoman complex creates a lot of success for us individually in the world, but it also comes with a lot of sacrifice and health challenges, and we declare our right to be well while doing good. And so that continues to be a focus. That network, because it's so global, we're able to access through Reunity members and leadership, people like Lema Bowie, the Honorable Lema Bowie, Nobel Prize laureate, was one of our keynote speakers for our Black Philanthropy Month Africa Summit last week. Yeah, just an amazing array of male, female, non-binary talent that just comes through this amazing network of Black women in 30 countries throughout the world. Now, even if they're not doing the hands-on organizing of our annual Black Philanthropy Month campaign, we often say Black philanthropy is giving time, talent, treasure, ties, and voice. They give us ties and they give us voice so that we have been able to do amazing things that I alone, as a person, as the founder and chief architect, would never be able to do on my own. So it's a great sisterhood, and with some new leaders who joined, we have a really intergenerational, diverse network of people whose sole purpose.
Congratulations on 10 years.
Yeah, for Black Philanthropy Month, but 20 years for Reunity. So yeah, that's the big deal this year, is we're celebrating 10 years of Black Philanthropy Month, but 20 years for Reunity.
So you've mentioned the action plan that you're putting in place, as well as the measures to, or things to quantify and measure the growth in investment in Black communities. So with that in mind, as you think about the next 10 years, where do you hope that Black philanthropy is 10, 15 years from now, as we're talking about Black Philanthropy Month 10 years out, 15 years out?
Well, first of all, because we have moved into this new phase, well, first, it's not my action plan. There's polling and there's surveys worldwide. So that is our action plan. And I say that because different institutions having ownership of it and a willingness to implement it worldwide is critical to the success of our funding equity vision. So I would hope in 10 to 15 years that we have been a force for funding equity, first and foremost. Second, I would hope that there is more collaboration between Black philanthropies and Black businesses. And because to me, they're flip sides of the funding equity and economic empowerment equation. When you think about the US, as African Americans give $12 billion a year, and so do African immigrants, that's a $24 billion giving economy. How can we use those resources to also support our businesses, financial education, so that our communities know how to access venture capital, know how to access impact investing and become impact investors themselves. I also hope that we're in a global economy, and African Americans and other people of African descent need to have a global identity to allow them to move more nimbly across all of the business and other opportunities that just exist in the Black diaspora in Africa. And so we would hope that the massive network, we've engaged 18 million people in 60 countries, becomes kind of an infrastructure for philanthropy, for business investment, and making what sometimes seems like a very ephemeral global Black identity real for people. I would hope that we'd also become a model for the entire social and economic justice movement worldwide, for how one can engage people of different, very diverse backgrounds, help them build common cause, sustain oneself over time, and actually change the world. That's the business that we're in. And I always remember, and Dr. Martin Luther King said, that the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I feel like we're making a little dent in the arc, and that we will be able to create measurable economic justice for people everywhere, or at least inspire it in the next 10 to 15 years.
Well, thank you so much for that. Thank you for inspiring us today, for sharing with us your journeys, the work that you're doing, the work that's going on in the world, really, to help communities here locally, nationally, and globally. So thank you again for joining us.
Well, I was happy to be here and just to have the conversation. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Ideas to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.